Patrick Smalley is the editor and co-founder of Business Desk and has reported on the New Zealand economy and business since 1983. He's in the Tamaki Makaurau Auckland studio today. Kia ora, Patrick.
Kia ora, Catherine.
So, another Reserve Bank monetary policy statement coming next week.
Yeah. Yeah, with a lot of speculation as to whether it would go another 50 basis points, which would take it from 4.75%, which is now, to 5.25%, which most economists are picking as the top, shouldn't go beyond that. I guess the thing that everyone's wondering about is the extent to which the Reserve Bank will be taking into account the wobbles that we're seeing in the global financial sector at the moment, particularly European and US regional banks. That story seems to change from day to day, but it is having an impact on the way that European Central Bank, the Bank of England, and the US Federal Reserve are thinking about their role, it's not just a dual mandate. One of the things they have to do is to try to keep inflation under control, but they also have to manage financial stability. So to the extent that the instability that we're seeing in some of these banks is actually an artifact, if you like, of the very fast run-up in interest rates that we've seen over the last couple of years. It's a bit like when you're driving in Auckland in those floods, you're not quite sure whether to tap the brakes or just keep ploughing on. I think the tendency will be to tap the brakes. If it looks as if that uncertainty is going to continue, I think the problem for New Zealand, or for the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, is that there are some quite strong inflationary impulses in our economy, in the domestic economy, which can be at least affected by, if not controlled by, monetary policy. And so they will be weighing up pretty hard whether to go the whole hog and just get on with it. If they do go the whole hog, that's really going to advance the mortgage refinancing pain that something like half of New Zealanders who have a mortgage will experience in the next 12 months or so.
It's interesting, in the United States, there was another rise last week, I think. Mm. So it is a balance, as you say, the thought that stability now might become an issue. I was trying to understand exactly why some of these banks are exposed, and the second-tier banks so far, but the panic doesn't necessarily look into the details, right, the risk of panic. Bond volatility appears to have been one factor if they were excessively exposed to bonds.
Yep.
It's or is it what, just not having sufficient reserves and getting caught out? What are some of the issues?
It's a bit of all of the above, in the sense that the particular issue with Silicon Valley Bank was that it had large deposits which it wasn't necessarily lending out, and so it was holding a lot of that deposited money in a treasury stock, which was basically they were horribly out of the money as interest rates began to rise. It's difficult to explain exactly how the bond market works. It's a kind of a back to front mathematics, but the higher interest rates rose and the more quickly they did so, the more the bank was exposed to very substantial losses. In the European case, both Credit Suisse and Deutsche Bank, which has been in the news a bit in the last couple of days but seems to be stabilizing, simply have been in difficulty for quite some time. And again, the change in financial market conditions, which are ultimately to do with rising interest rates and a period of sustained inflation, which we haven't seen for a couple of decades, has been the fundamental underlying problem that those banks have had to deal with. It does seem as if the Swiss authorities may have got on top of Credit Suisse. Deutsche Bank is a kind of a separate story in the sense that it's been in trouble one way or another for a long time, but has kind of rode back from the brink of disaster some years ago. And certainly overnight, there have been enough theatrical flourishes from various financial authorities in Europe to suggest that things are kind of stabilising. But it is interesting that it doesn't, people feel better about it and then something new happens. So I think the Reserve Bank here is keeping its powder dry a little bit. I mean, obviously, our banks are not going to be affected by this. Our banks are well capitalised. and were in the global financial crisis as well. We came through the GFC well. We came through COVID well. We'll be fine in terms of our own savings and our own banks. But it's the old thing about when the world catches a, sneezes, we catch a cold. So it will have impacts, not least on if other central banks don't raise their interest rates as fast as we do. You get all these pass-on effects through things like a stronger New Zealand dollar exchange rate, which then has a disinflationary effect. Anyone who tells you that they understand how all these things fit together in a kind of mechanical way is lying or deluded, because they don't fit together in a mechanical way. But the thing you would expect is that if our interest rates are higher, more people will put money into New Zealand. That will raise the value of the dollar. Our inflation will fall faster. So you may not need to go quite as hard on the official cash rate as a result.
The other question they must be looking at is whether we are entering recession or near enough to earlier than anticipated. We've got that first quarter of negative growth in December. We'll find out what's happened this quarter ending just now. Whether it's technically a bit over zero or a bit under zero, is the economy in a slowdown earlier than anticipated?
Look, if it is, it's only, to me, it's marginal. I think we should just simply accept that we are in a recession now. The conditions are certainly recessionary. Whether it's two quarters of negative growth, that bizarre expression, or three or four, is less important than whether it's happening or not. And how deep it is. And at this stage, it looks to be shallow, could be a bit prolonged. The fact that it's starting to happen now might mean that by the end of the year, inflation will be coming back. And, certainly looking at some work that CoreLogic, the housing market analyst, put out yesterday, they're certainly expecting by the end of this year, mortgage interest rates will be starting to fall again. Certainly into next year, it's reasonable to think that they will be. It's just that they'll peak in the course of this year at the same time as the recessionary impulse peaks. It's kind of what they're trying to engineer, really, to slow things down, take the heat out of the economy, and then go back into a low inflation growth mode. That's the theory.
Yeah, that's what we're hoping, and that's where the supply side stuff is outside of your control, right? To do with global conflicts and natural disasters, and
things like food prices in New Zealand. Monetary policy can't change the fact that Hawke's Bay got flooded, and you can't get a Coomera for love or money out of Northland. So they will look through those kinds of impacts.
So 25 basis points or potential for a higher move, a second 50 basis point move, and that's what we'll be looking to see. What is your view on whether the inflation target is going to hold? Now, is this ultimately at the hands of the finance minister as to whether the instructions to the Reserve Bank get changed? Because currently it's 1% to 3%. It's been a while since we were there. But we were there for a good while and quite low in that band at times. But given
below 1% all the time.
Yeah. I mean, I remember debates over whether inflation was dead and all these arguments that now feel like they were an awfully long time ago.
Yeah.
Again, forgetting supply side impulses when things go wrong. But what is your take on whether there will be a political tolerance to keep looking through and perhaps missing a mark, or a debate will start about whether the band should move? And who instigates that?
I think that the debate has started about whether the band should move internationally amongst economists. The political attraction of it is only going to start to become apparent when inflation starts falling. I don't think a government that's committed to price stability is likely to start talking about a higher inflation target when inflation is still above 7%. But say it starts to drift back down maybe a bit more between 3 and 4, and things have stabilised and the economy is growing again, pushing for that last little bit start to get it back to the 2% mid-range target of in the current band of 1 to 3% starts to look less important, perhaps, than ensuring that your economy grows, that see a bit of jobs growth and so on. I think the other thing that's particularly tempting for governments which have created an enormous amount of debt over the last few years is that even a little bit more inflation inflates away the value of that debt much more quickly. I mean, obviously, it also inflates away the value of savings. Our columnist and business desk, Cameron Bagri, made the point this morning that at 2% inflation, your savings halve over 35 years. At 4% inflation, they halve in value over 17 and a half years. If you're 65 years old and contemplating 17 and a half years of retirement, more or less, before you clock out, obviously that's not a particularly attractive look. But if you're a government that's got enormous debt and with a long maturity date, then maybe a little more inflation isn't going to
matter. It's a temptation for governments to inflate away debt, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we started at 0 to 2% back in 1990-ish. We went to 1 to 3, I think, in about 2002. We've been there since then. We are in a more inflationary time now. The sort of clogging up of supply chains, the way that countries are, the geopolitics is changing, international trade and the competitiveness of goods and services means that things are going to be more expensive as a result. I think that's a medium-term shift that's occurred really over the COVID period, but not so much because of COVID as because of the change dynamics between the East and the West, if you like, during that time.
You want to look at whether it's time to reform law on genetically modified organisms, GMOs, and gosh, when was the Royal Commission? Early 2000s, I think. It has been
early 2000s.
A kind of a passionate subject among some. It's also kind of a blunt description, isn't it, as to, you know, modifying something that is used and isolated in a the production of a pharmaceutical, for example, and then you go all the way through to CRISPR and the possibility of altering genes that are passed on through generations that are passed on reproductively, and then you get into the resistance arguments. And it's hard to sometimes chart a course through a very complex subject. Is our law, however, in itself too simplistic in the way it's approaching this?
Well, I think it is arguably because it's a creature of a particular time. I mean, I lived in the States briefly in 97, 98 and came back, and GMOs were just starting to appear in things like corn crops and bread and so forth, and being a trusting bunch, I guess, at that point. This was generally reported in American media as being, you know, as being advances of some sort. I got back to New Zealand and discovered a raging debate about Franken tomatoes and so forth. And it was very emotive, it was very poorly understood, and there were some real areas of concern about gene editing, you know, living organisms, particularly mammals, animals. But I think it's changed a heck of a lot in the last 20-something years. I mean, the debate has not yet successfully been reframed in New Zealand, although I'm talking about this today because it's come up at the Life Sciences Summit this week, and you know, the Prime Minister's Chief Science Advisor, Juliet Gerrard, describes the current law as an ass, and then wondered whether she was going to get reported saying that, and perhaps she shouldn't have. But
well, you've done it for now, Petra.
The thing is, genetic modification, gene editing, whatever you want to call it, is showing already enormous potential to help with climate change, either in crop adaptation or in things like reducing methane emissions from ruminant animals. It's obviously got huge application for life-saving or enhancing medical technologies. It's got the capacity to improve the quality of a whole bunch of things that we eat and drink, as long as it's all properly labelled. I think that one of the interesting things that Julia Gerard said yesterday is it would help if the science community was better able to say, yes, there are some things about GMOs or the use of this technology which are ethically questionable, potentially socially disruptive or dangerous. Let's be honest about that, but then let's also have a conversation about the risk and reward to be had from some of the other GMO technologies that have emerged and which are simply not available to New Zealand. I mean, we're a food-producing nation, a food and fibre-producing nation. I don't see that changing in a hurry. You look across the ditch to Australia, very large biotech listed company environment, huge amounts of capital being poured into basically modern agricultural science, which includes GM science. We do risk missing the boat, and I think that the argument that used to be put that says, you know, we should be the world's organic nation has been exposed for the problem that it is, which is that A, the demand's not necessarily there, and B, the returns are probably not there either.
Is it a case that we often tend to be such light-handed regulators? You know, and even looking at what's going on with the slash debate, and I know we were touched on that last week, the slash debate in Tairāwhiti, and, you know, pollutants. Would people tolerate going there if we felt like there was sufficient oversight and checks and balances against decisions corporates make, typically corporates make, that impact negatively on others?
Only if there's clear reward. I mean, I think that
there's reward, but do we manage the risk of the downside? This is my point. Would people trust more if they felt like that there was a sufficient oversight regime?
I think they would have to feel that that was there. I mean, there are lots of people who don't think that there are all kinds of, who see New Zealand as being too lightly regulated, and in some areas we have quite a bit of regulation that isn't well enforced. I mean,
there's a lot of that, actually. You know, there's a lot of that. It's not even the absence of regulation, it's the lack of enforcement.
Yeah, so yes, that is an issue. That is probably going to limit the extent to which you can push the boundaries of where people are willing to see these new technologies applied. But where the application of that technology has a very clear benefit for a particular problem, it's more likely that you can win the argument, not so much on the basis of whether the regulation is going to work or not, but on the basis of whether it's going to solve a problem or not. So, the things that occur to me are particularly methane from cows and sheep and the potential to basically breed out exotic pests like possums and rabbits, which are, decimating our native flora and fauna and making the challenge of dealing with climate change that much more difficult.
All right, let's finish with, it's election year, Patrick, and were you toying with joining the speculation of whether it might be brought forward or what?
Look, it's more of a thought experiment than a prediction, but it just seems to me likely that Chris Hipkins is peaking right now. He's had a fantastic run since taking over from Jacinda Ardern. The election is much more of a toss-up than it was at the end of last year. Christopher Luxon is still finding his feet as a politician, let alone as leader of the opposition. And if I was looking into the rest of this year and was the PM, I would at least be tempted because, interest rates are going to rise further, lots of people are going to reset their mortgages. Everybody who either owns or largely owns their house is going to be watching the value of that house fall, probably for the rest of the year. So economic sentiment is going to be pretty droopy to say the least, and probably will be at its most negative towards the end of the year. There will be some bad economic news. There will be some job losses, some failures here and there. And I just can't help but think, if you had a generous, well-pitched budget, and you had a clever set, particularly of a new tax policy that wouldn't involve a capital gains tax. I know a lot of people seem to be speculating about that possibility from Labor. I can't see why they would go down that self-mutilating route again. Yeah, there might be a chance that you could actually pull off a win which otherwise looks very unlikely.
It's an interesting one. I was trying to remember the last early election.
2002,
and Clark called it. And
Labor was at 55% when
right.
she called
that's
it.
That's what I was going to say, though.
And they came in at about 40.
Yeah, but that was the Corngate election, ironically. Let's link back to your earlier GMO. And there was a huge scrap between Labor and the Greens, and both got punished for it.
Yep.
But they were...
It was also National's worst election showing ever until 2020.
True. So, but that said, the reason... She went early. I'm trying to remember the reasoning that was given. There was something clucked out of a hat. And you don't have to have a reason anyway, right? But the going at 55% and when your opponent was languishing down in the 20s or whatever in the polls, they're not in that situation at the moment. There's more of a gamble associated with calling an early election this time, Patrick. But are you saying the odds aren't going to get better in your assessment?
My assessment is that they probably that the government is re-elected at its most re-electable now. And obviously, I don't know that because it's in the future. But that would be my assessment that Hipkins has done a great job of repositioning Labor. He's been, nobody wishes for cyclones and floods. But they have given him a platform that's just basically obliterated any interest in what the opposition has to say until pretty much last week, when they did okay with a bunch of new education policy.
They'll be watching what's happening to the opposition leader's own personal ratings, though, the beauty contest that Mike Williams used to refer to it, former Labour Party president, and they'll be wondering whether that is going to be a further lag on the headline number. Look, it's an interesting one, Patrick. It's just such a razor-thin situation at the moment. It would be a hell of a call, and you might forever be wondering what if.
Yep. Well, I'm not predicting it. I'm just saying
that you're not the first to suggest it.
The conditions are there.
Yeah, interesting. Post-budget then. And then when would you hold it? Would you hold it? We've got to line up the All Black tests, first of all, if we still
really
do
that.
We've got time-shifted listing now, viewing.
Yes, because it's my holiday.
So when would you do it? Would you go late July? Got to avoid the school holidays.
I guess middle of winter. Not great. Not a great time to hold an election. Might just be a matter of, I think they're more likely to hang on. But talking about an early election is a way of framing a view that
things are going to get better before they get worse.
Yeah, Labor could well be peaking right now.
Yeah. Always fascinating. Thank you so much for your time. Patrick Smalley, editor and co-founder of Business Desk, has reported on the New Zealand economy and business since 1983.